Today I'm going to focus more on decolonizing paradigms of political economy. Tomorrow I'm going to go more in depth into the question of decolonizing Western universalism, and then the proposal that was mentioned yesterday, Enrique Dussel's transmodernity. I'm going to go in depth tomorrow on that. Today we might mention it, you know, again, but transmodernity is, as I said yesterday, some people that you might know talk about modernity as a project that is unfinished and unfulfilled, and that the political project of our time is to make that project complete and extend that project around the world. That's Habermas, right? Some people think about it in post-colonial studies as plural or multiple modernities. Other people talk about post-modernity. I would say that all the three perspectives are Eurocentric critiques of Eurocentrism. I mentioned yesterday in depth, in more detail, the question about how there is no modernity without coloniality. And thus, the project of modernity is a project that is not emancipatory. It's a project of domination. It's a civilizational project that has from its roots, from its beginnings until today, we know what modernity is. We know their consequences. Using a phrase used by indigenous movements in the South, is a project of death, and therefore is a project that is not leading us anywhere except to the destruction of life. Given that, we are thinking in terms of transmodernity. Transmodernity is a project to go beyond modernity. What does that entail? It will require some of the things I mentioned yesterday, and I will go in depth into things I did not mention yesterday tomorrow. But transmodernity is the project to fulfill the incomplete and unfinished project of decolonization. As I will explain today, decolonization and colonial relations are still with us, despite the fact, or despite the 20th century myth, that with the end of colonialism, colonial relations are over. I would say that's a 20th century myth. I would say that we're still living in a colonial world. And I will try to explain that today. Now, let me first say that something we're going to discuss in more detail tomorrow, the question about from where you're thinking from, that leads into the question of geopolitics of knowledge and body politics of knowledge. That is, from which body and from which location in space, in power relations, at a world scale you're thinking from, is a fundamental epistemic question. Part of what happened with the Western tradition of thought, of which I'm going to go in detail tomorrow, why I'm saying this, is that this tradition tries to hide the body and the space in power relations from which these thinkers are thinking from. I mentioned yesterday that this tradition is inherently epistemically sexist and racist. Those of you who are here yesterday, you understand what I mean. Tomorrow I will go in depth into that. It's an inherently sexist project because if you look at the canon of thought of the West, Western social science, Western humanity, Western philosophy, it's all about European males or Western males as the central composition of the people we read. Now, these Western males are not all Western males. It's only Western males of five countries. You could narrow it down to only five countries: Italy, France, Germany, UK, and the USA. Just check the curriculum of the people you read, or of the guys you read, okay? Of the guys you read in westernized universities. You will see that it's, you know, fundamentally 90% of these five countries. So even within the West, it's a very narrow way of thinking about this, because the West is very heterogeneous and there are many other experiences. But the experience of only five countries is what we call scientific social science, or scientific theory, or social theory. Okay? You cannot have it more provincial than that. So what I'm calling for in the talk I gave yesterday is for epistemic diversality as a point of departure for decolonizing knowledge and for decolonizing the westernized university. That means that's not an easy task. That means decolonizing the university from being universal, that is one defining for everybody, okay, to be pluriversal, where you have multiple epistemic critical perspective talking to each other, and where the university, instead of being universities, is a pluriversity. That means that in our curriculum we can have access to the critical knowledge produced in other experiences around the world. That we don't have. We are still run by a kind of a Eurocentric fundamentalism that is so ingrained in our structures of knowledge and power that we don't even think about it. We just think about it as normality. The definitions that we have of democracy, human rights, women's liberation, you name it, is all framed within this Western-centric perspective. We don't read anybody else except, you know, that tradition of thought. And so we think that the rest is inferior to the West, and we consider the knowledge produced in other coordinates inferior. So I call this tradition sexist and racist, because it's sexist because it doesn't take seriously the knowledge produced by women, Western women and non-Western women. It doesn't matter. It's not. Recently, you will have a footnote with a Western woman somewhere just because of the advances of feminist critiques, and so many guys of this tradition now will put a footnote there to cover themselves, but they're not really taking that seriously. And of course, non-Western women are completely out of the conversation. And non-Western males are also completely out of the conversation. And that's why I call it racist sexist. It's an epistemic racist sexist tradition, because it installs a superiority inferiority based on an epistemic hierarchy of superior knowledge, inferior knowledge, to the point that that inferior knowledge is not even considered knowledge. It's considered mythology, religion, culture, or things like that. It's not at the level of knowledge. Not even scientific knowledge. Okay, not to talk about science. But anyway, having said this, this implies, if I will give you an example today with political economy paradigms of what it entails to decolonize knowledge. One of the things, fundamental things, it will entail is what the Caribbean Philosophical Association slogan is, they call shifting the geography of reason. That means shifting the way, the location from where we're thinking, the space location from where we're thinking. And so the slogan of the Caribbean Philosophical Association is shifting the geography of reason. That's a response to Immanuel Kant, who used to say that reason was north of the Pirin Mountains. Pirin Mountains are, for those who don't know, north of Spain, the border between Spain and France. So Immanuel Kant will push even Spaniards and Portuguese people outside the realms of reason, because he will say these people are too contaminated with African, Muslim, Arab cultures, which for him were inferior to the white man. And he used the color racism. He used the term white to talk this way. And he would say, of course, that red people, black people, yellow people have no access to reason. And of course, he didn't talk about women, because it was a common sense of the time that women of all colors, doesn't matter. They have no access to reason. They were irrational beings. And so the response of the Caribbean Philosophical Association is shifting the geography of reason. This is very interesting if we look at paradigms of political economy, because paradigms of political economy will begin by saying that they will be looking at the history of European colonial expansion, looking at Europe expanding. That is, looking from Europe expanding to the rest of the world. That is, it's a very Eurocentric view. Even the most critical people within that tradition of thought, within the paradigms of political economy, they will be looking at Europe expanding. Now, if we use the slogan of the Caribbean Philosophical Association and ask for what will entail to shift the geography of reason in political economy, that will entail not looking at Europe expanding, but Europe arriving. That is, how does the world look like instead of Europe expanding, looking at Europe arriving, that is, from the other side of the Atlantic? How will an indigenous woman or an African slave in the Americas, in that geopolitical location or spatial location, how will the system look like, that system that expanded since 1492, if you look at it from that side of the Atlantic, instead of looking at it from here over there? Now, this is a very important exercise because it's about shifting the geopolitics of knowledge. That is, shifting, and this is not, just because you're born and raised in Europe doesn't mean you're not able to do it. Okay, let me just clarify that. And not, in that sense, we're not essentialists, that because you're born in a certain place, you're unable to be able to take the geopolitical and body political knowledge production of other spaces and other bodies in the world. I mean, you could learn also from the perspective of people in other places. Part of what happened is that, as I said at the beginning and yesterday, the westernized university, as well as in general the westernized countries, they don't take seriously the knowledge produced from that other side of the equation. Okay, so they will look only from one side. And those who are thinking from the other side are inferiorized. So they're not taken seriously. They're out of the conversation. So shifting the geography of reason in this case will mean, in political economy, how will the structures of the global system that emerged in 1492 look like if, instead of looking at Europe expanding to the Americas, you look at Europe arriving to Tahuantinsuyo, okay? Or Teotihuacan, okay, which were the names of that region we call today Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, or we call today Mexico, Guatemala, etc. You know, there were different names than what we have today, because even the names of territories, geographies, continents, etc., have changed after 1492. They're not the same names that had before. And even if they carry the same name, they don't mean the same thing after 1492. And they don't mean the same boundaries. So there is a major shift in terms of identity. All our identities are pretty much shaped by this modern colonial world. It has become so commonsensical that we don't even think about this. You know, how was it called in 1491? Okay, those regions of the world. Okay, we take for granted these names. Anyway, so if you look at Europe expanding, and this is what many political economists do, you will look primarily at a new global economic logic that emerged with the European colonial expansion to the Americas. That, if you remember your history books, it was the first moment of that expansion was done by the Spaniards to the Americas in 1492, in the late 15th century. And this move created a global market of selling commodities for a profit That is what we have called since then capitalism or global capitalism. And so many paradigms in political economy look at this as a fundamental logic of the system we live in. Now, the second thing they see, or you can see Europe expanding, okay, is a global interstate system of states, political military organizations that also expand and enforce a global division of labor in the world of metropolitan centers and peripheral regions. Okay? Peripheral regions are not definitions, essential definitions. They are relational definitions. You're a periphery in relation to a metropolitan center. You're a metropolitan center in relation to a periphery. That means that peripheral regions were submitted to domination and exploitation through violence, through military power, okay, through the European colonial expansion. That means that a lot of wealth were extracted from these territories and concentrated in metropolitan centers, in this case in European empires. Over time, the dominant or hegemonic powers or empires in this European war economy that emerged in 1492 will shift over time. You have the Spaniards and Portuguese having the central role in the 16th century. You will have the Dutch in the 17th century. And you will have the British in the 19th, the Americans in the late 20th century. And you will have, every time you have a hegemonic power coming to take over, it's always after a war and always with rivalries, challenging the hegemonic power. And that's why you have wars, because you have several empires competing with each other in terms of who's going to take over the declining hegemonic power before. And this is what we have been living over the last 500 years. And what we call world wars, that in fact are European empire wars, but we call it world wars, really rivalry about who is going to take over once a hegemonic power declines. There is a whole literature on this, okay, that we can go on it in terms of if you are interested. Anyway, so you have two global power structures. You have an international division of labor, core peripheries, organized around logic of capitalist accumulation at a world scale, and you have a global interstate system of core states and peripheral regions, okay, where the core states, usually over a period of 400 years, related with the peripheral regions primarily through colonial administrations. That is, colonial administration was the quintessential mean use over several centuries in this relationship between metropolitan centers and peripheral regions. That means that the myth that capitalism brings democracy is really a very mythological understanding, or that it brings free markets. No, it depends from where you look at the world. If you look at the world from the peripheral regions, there was never any referendum put forward by the colonizers when they arrived to the colonies asking, you want to be a slave, you want to be a free laborer, you want to be a colonial subject, or you want to be a free citizen. There was no democratic decision making. It was imposed by force all over the world. And that lasted over a period of 400 years. That's not irrelevant if we think about the fact that full decolonization in terms of colonial administration is a 60 years period. It's only in the last 60 years. And in many regions of the world, it's only a thing of 30 years or 40 years. Okay? So if you think about it carefully, about the time length, the impact of that history into the present is a very, very strong one. You cannot just disappear 400 years of this history in 60 years. Okay, this is still an ongoing legacy that we have inherited. Everybody in the world, okay, we are all affected by that history, even as distant as it looks like if you happen to be at the core of the empire. You are affected by that history in many ways that we're going to go in details. So, if we keep looking at the world from Europe expanding, that will be the primary logic of the system. It will be capital accumulation, international division of labor, and global interstate system. And then the rest of the forms of oppression will be things that won't be new, and therefore won't be a fundamental logic of the system. For example, patriarchy. I have these debates with people like Giovanni Arrighi, Manuel Wallerstein, all the people of the world system literature, because I always tell them, well, what about patriarchy? And they will say, well, that's not new. That has been there for 5,000 years. So that's not new in the new system created by the Europeans in the 15th century. Left me thinking. Then I say, and what about hierarchies like religious oppression, because the colonizers went with the church everywhere, Protestant or Catholic, but they went around the world preaching something, no? Well, but that the church had been there also for several thousand years. That's not new. Okay. And so, but what about linguistic oppression? Oh, but linguistic oppression had been there also for a long time. So the only thing that matters is the logic of capital accumulation and the political and military organization that enforces it. That's it. And then all you need to look at is the cycles, the economic cycles of the system, and that's enough to understand the world we live. And I say, well, there's something here that doesn't sound correct. I'm a Puerto Rican. I'm a colonial subject inside the U.S. empire. Okay, we are still a colony of the U.S. today. And I asked myself, well, this kind of doesn't make sense to the history I know. But anyway, I started continue thinking about this. But of course, once you change the geography of reasons, then the things that are invisibilized in the critical thinking produced from the zone of being. Everybody was here yesterday? Anyway, the zone of being. You remember that? Okay, you have the zone of being. And the zone of non-being. It's too bad because I'm doing this as a seminar. I was invited to teach a seminar. That's why I'm doing a piece each time and connecting the dots. I'm not doing everything every day. So the problem with that is that if people miss one, then they can get lost in the next one. But anyway, that's always a risk. So you have zone of being, zone of non-being. And I was mentioning how this is a fundamental structure of the system we live, because then I explained yesterday the debate between Las Casas and Sepulveda, so I'm not going to go into that now, of, you know, superior, inferior beings. Okay, this is a structural domination on the line of the human. People who are above are the zone of being, people who are below are the zone of non-being. I'm talking about a structure of a system. I'm not saying that I believe in this, okay, please. I'm saying this is the structure of a system and has a logic in the way it operates, okay? I'm trying to understand the logic in the way it operates. So this is a very heterogeneous space. This is a, both spaces are very heterogeneous. This is not a geography because you could find this structure in Berlin, Paris, or London today. I mean, you could find it inside the so-called zone of being. You could find zones of non-being too. And so, I was mentioning how dialectics of I and other apply in the zone of being. Because in the zone of being, the humanity, there are conflicts, class conflict, gender conflict, sexual conflict, political conflicts, economic conflict, you name it, all kinds of conflicts, a heterogeneous space. What differentiates the zone of being from the zone of non-being is that the humanity of the people inside the zone of being is recognized. Therefore, the way the conflicts are regulated is going to be different, because that means that codes of law, civil rights, human rights, democratic rights, etc., are recognized despite the conflicts. That means that if you want to organize a labor union in a factory, the owner of the factory might put all kind of trouble, you know, might try to do all kind of things to you, but you won't be killed, okay? you won't be killed. That's very exceptional in the zone of being. In the zone of being, a worker who tries to organize a union risks their life. Because the way conflicts are regulated here is through violence and appropriation as a constant, as a trend, okay? With exceptional moments of peaceful regulation of conflicts. Human rights, civil rights, democratic processes are not recognized in the zone of non-being. Okay? Now, so the zone of non-being is a zone where, that goes back to colonial times, where people were considered below the line of the human, non-humans of human, and therefore certain codes of law or certain ethical procedures won't apply. Because these, in fact, are like animals. It's like the animal kingdom. So, in the eyes of God, it's not a sin to enslave the people there or even kill them or whatever, because it's like animals. And the same thing when the Christian cosmology gets secularized in the 19th century, where you could do the same thing because, in the eyes not of God but of the law, it's not penalized if you kill a colonial subject or you crush a rebellion or whatever. So, codes of law do not apply. So, these are different zones. Okay? I explained that yesterday in more detail. We're going to continue with this. The thing is that here, dialectics of I and other do not apply because there's no recognition of the humanity of the people here. The question is, what happened if you look at the European colonial expansion from the zone of being? Okay, I was mentioning the most you can see as new in the new system is this international illusion level and the interstate system that accompany it, articulated to the global accumulation of capital, you know, at a world scale. And that's what most political economy, the critical theories of this eye, which is the imperial masculinist eye. The critical thinking produced from the zone of being, okay, has some insights that are important, but some limits in terms of how far they go in the critique to this eye. Now, when you shift the geography of reason to the zone of non-being and look at the same historical process of European expanding, and instead of looking at it from the point of view of European expanding, you see it as European arriving, then what happened is that many things that are invisibilized from the critical thought of the other in the zone of being become visibilized. Okay? For example, if you look at that expansion from the perspective of indigenous women in the Americas or African slaves in the Americas, you could see very clearly that what arrived was not just a logic of capital accumulation with a political military organization enforcing it. It was more than that. It was a package of multiple power relations that came simultaneously in time, at the same time, to the Americas. And that multiplicity becomes visible when you shift the geographical reason, or when you take seriously the critical thinking produced from this zone about the same process. For example, when the political economy theorists answered to me, well, what about patterning? They would say, well, it's been there forever. Why are you, this is not new. They say, well, it depends. If you look at it from the point of view of indigenous movement in the Americas, what you get is not just patriarchy, it's Judeo-Christian patriarchy. That's what I write there. So it's not patriarchy, it's Judeo-Christian patriarchy. That means that there is a hierarchy that comes together with the political economy of the world system that is Judeo-Christian patriarchy and implies a particular form of thinking about gender and about sexuality. And that did not exist in America before 1492. That did not exist. As a matter of fact, all the studies show today that in America there was no patriarchy. In most of the territories of the Americas, indigenous people have zero patriarchy. There was a complete different system of political organization between male and female that was completely different from even a concept of patriarchy. Okay? There were other places of the world where there was non-European forms of patriarchy, non-Judeo-Christian forms of patriarchy, and where the colonizers either destroyed or hybridized with them or used the local ones for the colonial project. Now, you need to look that in the concrete. You cannot say a priori, oh, this is what happened everywhere. You need to look in each region of the world how this colonial encounter produced particular forms of gender and sexual relations in each place. You cannot think about the word system as if it was asexual or degender. This word system came with a particular vision about gender and sexuality in the colonial project, and it was Judeo-Christian, period. That was it. So it was not patriarchy, like some abstract thing. It was Judeo-Christian patriarchy, something very concrete, and with a very particular logic. So to say that there was, that's not new because it's been here for 5,000 years, well, that's a very Eurocentric view, because it's taking European local history as world history. The fact that it existed here for several thousand years doesn't mean it existed over there at all. In other places of the world, that did not exist. That there were other forms of thinking about this and organizing about this. Okay? So you need to think about Judeo-Christian patriarchy and the gender and sexual relation that emerged from it as a logic of the political economy of the world system. Okay? Second, what about religious hierarchies, such as Christian religion becoming dominant? Okay? Well, they would say, well, that's not new. I mean, look, we have Christianity here for several thousand years. Why are you bringing that up? Say, well, wait a minute. It might be in European history, Christendom might be there for several thousand years, but that doesn't mean that it was there in what we call the Americas in 1491. And that doesn't mean it was there in many parts of Asia, Africa, etc. So why are you leaving that out of the picture of the global hierarchies of the system? Okay, so if you shift the geography of reason and look at it from the other side, then that was there from day one. That was not, the colonizers arrived with the church, Christian or Protestant, you name it. So that has to be accounted in the global hierarchies of the system we live. Okay? What about forms of pedagogy? What about language? What about aesthetic forms? Well, all of this is a package of multiple power relations that constitute what I'll be calling here the coloniality of power. That is, I'm going to be distinguishing colonialism from coloniality. Okay? Colonialism is the presence of a colonial administration. That is, the hegemonic form in which metropolitan center relate with the periphery was through putting a colonial administration to control the place, dominate and exploit the place. Okay? But what happened is that out of that European colonial expansion over a period of 450 years, you have the formation of a global hierarchies of power together with that history. That is, the condition of possibility for coloniality is 450 years of colonialism. That is, the colonial administration was what created the possibility of a formation of a global system of multiple power relations that I will call this power relation the coloniality of power. Okay? The interesting thing is that even though coloniality or coloniality of power or this multiple power relation that I call the coloniality of power emerged out of the colonialism, of that history of colonialism, once colonialism is over, Once colonial administration disappeared, doesn't mean that the power relation that emerged out of that history that I'm calling here now colonial power also disappeared. Okay? And this is what I'm going to identify now. What are these power hierarchies that emerge of the history of colonialism that I will call coloniality as opposed to colonialism? Okay, that are the powers relations that emerge of the history of colonialism and that did not end with the demise of colonial administrations in the world, but that are still here with us today, constituting our social life, our subjectivity, our identities, everywhere, not just over there in the colonies, here at the center of empire. Okay? So this is what I'm going to identify now. So you have we mentioned here, let me see if I can read this way. Okay, we have here.
Could you take the other pen? We could read it better, I guess.
What?
Sorry. Can you take the other pen? It's better to read it.
So we have here. So we have here the International Division of Labor that is identified by most paradigms of political economy, okay, with core periphery, no? And with a particular class formation and with particular logic of capital accumulation and wealth scale. Then you have the global interstate system. And this global interstate system is again core states and peripheral states. Now, the International Division of Labor is talking about a relation of domination and exploitation. That's what it's talking about. That was formed in 1492 with the European colonial expansion that was institutionalized, the International Division of Labor, through the enforcement of colonialism, that is, Europeans arrived and put people to work in certain forms of coerced labor and to produce certain items. That was completely different from what existed there before European arrival. Okay? This was done, this couldn't be done democratically. It's nobody going to say, oh, you know what, I'm going to be your slave. Nobody's going to say that I will. That doesn't exist anywhere. Okay? So the way they did it was to bind. That's why you have the interstate system. So you have a political military organization enforcing this to get cheap raw material, cheap agrarian products, and to put people to work in coerced forms of labor. This lasted over a period of 400 years. This structure that I'm talking about, naming colonialism, okay, with the presence of colonial administration in different territories around the world. Okay. Now, you have, so it's a system that wealth produced here gets concentrated here. Now, this doesn't happen automatically, especially at the beginning of this system, the first 400 years. In order to get this flowing, this wealth flowing into the core, you need a political military apparatus to make it happen. Okay? Because things were not that ingrained. Okay? So this is the logic that is, and you know, basically understood when people look, political economy paradigms look at Europe expanding. What I'm going to say now, from now on, are things that the most sophisticated of these people in political economy would call superstructure or epiphenomenon or derivative or whatever. We look at this as secondary, but not as structural hierarchies of the system. What I'm going to say is the reverse. I'm going to say these are not superstructural or derivative or epiphenomenon. These things I'm going to talk about now are constitutive of the system we live, and are constitutive of the process of capital accumulation from within. Okay, this is what I'm going to say. But let me go over them first so you get an idea. So you have, at the same time, you have a global racial ethnic hierarchy. Thank you.
where you have Western people, westernized people, and non-Western people. These are categories that have been introduced by this history of colonialism. Okay? These are not categories I would like to use. I'm just telling you what are the categories used by this system. Okay? How they classify people. Okay? Now, this Western or Western is, remember the one before, zone of being, zone of non-being. Okay? Zone of being, zone of non-being. People, the superior and the inferior, along the line of the human. Okay? Now, there is a long history about this. Let me clarify the following. People, what is racism? Racism is a structure of power that is institutional, that is global, that defines some group of people as superior, some group of people as inferior, along the line of the human. That's what defines racism. The confusion of many people with this is that they take the particular expressions or historical forms that racism produced in different regions of the world as if it was the definition of racism. So, for example, one confusion that usually happens when people talk about racism is that immediately, in the common sense, in many places of the world where racism, color racism, has been so important historically, because it has been, they tend to think, when you talk about racism, about color. That is about, racism is about color. Okay? And they tend to define, if you don't see color racism in a particular place of the world, then there's no racism. That would be the conclusion. Okay? If people don't use color anymore to classify people, then there's no racism. That's a huge mistake. Because you're taking the form for the content. You're confusing the expression for the essence of the process. Okay? So for example, give you an example. People can say the conflict in Northern Ireland, where there was no color racism there. You know, the Irish and the British. There was no racism there. People, many people say, because nobody's talking about color. They are all whites. So there's no racism. So they're using color racism, which is a particular pervasive form that has been very important in the system we live, especially in the Americas, in the colonization of the Americas, and in the imaginary of many areas of metropolitan centers. But they take it as the definition. And then they come back and see Ireland and say, oh, there's no racism there. Okay? So the point I want to say is the following. What defines racism is not the particular form. It's a structure of superiority and inferiority along the line of the human. Now, that could be marked through many means. It could be marked through color, through religion, like in the Irish case, Protestant Catholics. And the Catholics, if you examine the way the Protestants spoke about the Catholics, it was exactly the way they would speak about Africans in the Americas. Okay? As inferior beings. But they would use the term Catholics. Because the color racism couldn't work in a context where everybody's color or skin was the same. So they use a different means to mark inferiority. And they use religion. There are other places in the world, like for example, many places in Africa today, where color skin doesn't work. In terms of color, but everybody is what we call in the West black. So there's no racism there? No, I'm sorry. Let's examine this carefully. There is racism marked through questions of ethnicity. So you have ethnic groups, elites from ethnic groups that have been privileged in colonial history by European empires, that once colonialism is over, they come to run the nation state, and then they inferiorize other ethnicities living inside that territory. But the way they mark the inferiority is not through color, it's through ethnic identification. Look at India, the Hindus the Hindus as the privileged group over the rest. That's a very racist structure when you examine carefully the discourses that are mobilized today, okay, vis-a-vis, but it's not color racism. It's religious racism, it's ethnic racism, it's, there are other forms of marking this superiority, inferiority. So what defines racism is not the particular form it takes in different historical contexts. It's a structure of superiority, inferiority along the line of the human. And that's what defines the zone of being and the zone of non-being. Okay? Now, I'm saying this because there is a common sensical way of getting confused about this by thinking when you think about racism, you think about color, and that doesn't work. In many instances, look at historical anti-Semitism in Europe. It was not about color of skin. Okay? It was about ethnic identification, religious identification, about then they will find features in your faith that might be, you know, tied to your ethnicity, but color was not in question. But that's still racist. So I'm saying this to open up the discussion about what is exactly racism, because today you will hear a lot of people saying, oh, you know what? There is Islamophobia in Europe, but that's not racism. Wait a minute, let's take a step back. Let's see how Muslim people are being classified, constructed, etc., before you say this is not racism. Because the fact that you don't have color racism doesn't mean that there's no racism in Islamophobic discourses today in Europe. Look at the extreme right all over Europe today, gaining a lot of votes in many places of Europe today, along Islamophobic discourses, and when you examine what they're saying, it's just, you know, bluntly racist discourse the moment they look at Muslims as inferior people, savages, barbarians, etc. No? And so there are all these narratives traveling in Europe today about Islam and Muslim Europeans, because the funny thing is that most of them are Europeans. They're born and raised here. They're not foreigners. Okay? They are from here. Sounds familiar to 1930s? Anyway, that's a question mark. So, the question is, how this structure, the West and non-West, how it operates. So I have been mentioning that this came together with the European colonial expansion. The moment the Europeans got out of the boat in the Americas, from day one, they brought this structure of racial classification of people. I mentioned yesterday the first thing that Columbus wrote in his diary, just a few hours after getting out of the boat, was these are people without religion. And I clarified yesterday that it's not. You read that today with the mentality today, you say, oh, then they were atheists. No. This comment is a very profound comment, because at the time in Christian cosmology, if you are Christian, you know, the Christian cosmology of the time, you're a human, you have a God, or you have many gods, but you have religion. It cannot be that there are humans without religion. You might have the wrong God. We might kill each other about that. But I won't question your humanity because you have a religion. When he said there, these are people without religion, he said, my God, these are people without religion. He's saying something else. He's saying, this cannot be human. That means they have no soul. And if they have no soul, they are like animals. And if they're like animals, then it won't be a sin in the eyes of God to enslave them. Okay, so this is what is behind the whole thing. And then that got expressed in many debates in 16th century Iberian Peninsula in Spain, all the way to the debate between Las Casas and Sepúlveda that we discussed yesterday. Anyway, so we have then the Judeo-Christian patriarchy with a particular configuration of gender global hierarchy and sexual global hierarchy. Okay? This is a global hierarchy of the system we live. Because Judeo-Christian patriarchy is privileged over other forms of thinking about sexuality and gender relations. Okay? This is the one that is hegemonic worldwide after 500 years of European colonial expansion. Okay? And then again, you have to look at this in the concrete. As I said, there were places in the world where there was no patriarchy, and the Europeans brought patriarchy there, Judeo-Christian. There were places that was no Judeo-Christian forms of patriarchy, and they were destroyed and implanted the Judeo-Christian. There were other places where they were hybridized with the Judeo-Christian one, the local patriarchal ones. There were places where the colonizers did not impose Judeo-Christian patriarchy and used the local one for the colonial project. And you need to look in the concrete about this in different regions of the world. You need to historicize this. Okay? This is very important methodologically, to not make mistakes of coming up with one experience and then universalizing that experience. It was the same everywhere. It's not the same everywhere. Okay? The same thing with sexuality. There were, in America, for example, there were many places where there was no homophobia or lesbophobia, you want to call it. Okay? Where sexual relations were considered a continuum in many indigenous empires and societies in the Americas. Okay? Where there was no discrimination based on sexual orientation, to the point that they have no word to distinguish heterosexuality from homosexuality or things like this. In their language, that didn't exist. In their artistic representation, it was overtly expressed: sexuality between men, sexuality between women, sexuality between men and women. All of this was expressed. The forms of organization were not the monogamy Judeo-Christian family. It was a different logic. The world was very diverse in 1491 than what we have today. Okay? But all these things were destroyed with the colonization of the Americas. That doesn't exist anymore in many places. Okay? So I'm saying this just for the sake of trying to understand what is at stake in the system we live. And so I'm saying that if you look at the system from the other side, from the geographical reason, you cheat the geographical reason, you're going to come up with global hierarchies of power that, looking at it from Europe, look as if they are not important, or they're secondary, or they're not new. You see, and therefore you won't give the same importance to it. But for someone who is in America, I've never heard of Judeo-Christian patriarchy, I've never heard of Christianity, I've never heard of superior and inferior beings, our human lives, or things like this, okay? All these things form part of a package of power relations that were came together with the European colonial expansion simultaneously. It was not that they first put the economy and later put racism. No, it was all coming together at the same time from day one. It's not that first they put the economy and then they put the church. It's not that first they put the economy and then they put the Judeo-Christian family. Okay. It was not like that. It all came together from day one, okay, in an entangled way. So, one thing that we need to understand here, you have male over female, and you have heterosexual over homosexual or lesbian. Okay? Now, one thing we need to understand here is, and I'm going to say now something that might shock you, but we can discuss it later, and here you have for the first time in world history, a patriarchal system in which a minority of women in the world have more power, more resources, and more prestige than the majority of the males in the world. For the first time in world history, I repeat, you have a patriarchal system in which a minority of women in the world have more power, more resources, and more prestige than the majority of the males in the world. That doesn't make sense if you look at this the way Western feminists look at this, which is isolated, this category is isolated from other dimensions. If you don't look at it intersectionally, if you look at it autonomously, then what I'm just saying is nonsense. But if you look at this intersectionally and you understand that racial ethnic hierarchy, the zone of being and the zone of not being, cut across gender and sexuality, okay, then the statement becomes more clear. I don't know if it's clear, but no? Okay, what I'm saying is that if you take racism, West, non-West, remember, zone of being, zone of not being. There are women in the zone of being that have conflicts, gender, sexual conflicts in the zone of being. But they have more resources, more power, and more prestige in the world than the majority of the males in the world, which are in the zone of non-being. How do you understand that? Well, you need to bring race into the picture to understand gender and sexuality. See the point? How this divides. Cut across gender. It's not the same thing to be oppressed as woman in the zone of being than to be oppressed as woman in the zone of non-being. It's not the same thing to be oppressed as gay in the zone of being than to be oppressed as gay in the zone of non-being. These are different experiences altogether. You cannot collapse them. That's why the black and indigenous and Chicana feminists comes up with the term intersectionality. That's not something that they sat down in the ivory tower of a university and they say, oh, let's see, how can we think about this otherwise, and then come up with an abstract concept. No. That's how do we account? This was the question. How do we account for our experience as black women or as indigenous women? Okay. Given that white feminism or westernized feminism have a different way of looking at questions of gender and sexuality, because they tend to isolate it from questions of race and class. That's when they came up with the concept of intersectionality, which is a concept of complexity. They said, the only way I can account for my experience is if I put together a multiplicity of oppressions, okay, that I live as a black woman. Race, class, sexuality, gender. I cannot account for my experience without having that entanglement. So it is not that they sat down in an ivory tower to invent a concept. It's that it was a concept that was relevant to account for the existential experience of a black woman, okay, in relation to black men and in relation to white women. How do you account for the specificity of that experience? Well, they were basically came up with this idea of intersectionality to look at how all these power structures get entangled. And now many westernized feminists are learning from this and taking the concept and using it in a very creative, interesting way. But the point is that this didn't come out of some kind of abstract theorization. It was coming out of the concrete experience lived by black women in the zone of non-being. The critical thinking produced from that experience. Okay? Now, if you look at epistemic hierarchies of European knowledges considered superior over non-European knowledge or Western knowledge. When I say European, I'm talking in a broad sense, not just from Europe. Okay, it's Western knowledges. Okay, it's not geographically, because with the European colonial expansion, now in the 16th century, the West and non-West, it was geographically very clear in the 16th century. But with the European colonial expansion, that becomes very messy and complex, because now in the 20th century or 21st century, you have Euro-Mexicans, Euro-Australians, Euro-Argentinians, Euro-Brazilians. So now, the West and the non-West is not just geographically divided, like Europe over here and the rest over there. Now you have inside each place the West and the rest. And you see it in Europe today, because now you have always had
for centuries here, the non-West, inside your territories.
Just take the Gypsies, or just take Jewish people for many centuries here
that were in the zone of non-being, okay? Or you take today the mass migration of migrants coming from the south.
So the zone of being non-being is not about, it's a relational concept. It's not anymore about a geography. Although it has geographical expression in each place you go. But this zone of superiority and inferiority, you could see in Brazil today. Euro-Brazilian vis-a-vis black Brazilian. Euro-Brazilian vis-a-vis indigenous Brazilian. That's happening in Brazil.
But you could see it here in Berlin or Paris or London. It doesn't matter. You see the same structures there.
Okay. So the fact that you have countries that are in the periphery, in general, that means that they're still in the periphery in the international division of labor, doesn't mean that everybody there belongs to the periphery. There are people inside the periphery that are having the lifestyle of the poor, of the metropolis living there, okay? And there are people, the fact that you have metropolitan centers getting all this wealth concentrated here doesn't mean that everybody here is enjoying those resources, okay? You also have people in the zone of being here. So we cannot be, I want to look, let's look at the complexity of this. You know, I'm trying to go in detail about this because it might be misunderstood as some kind of rigid structure where you have the West here and the rest of it there, when in fact this is more complex. You could have the West and the non-West inside the periphery and inside the core. Okay. These have material implications for the life of people. Okay? This is not just an abstract discussion, philosophy, being, not being. We're not there. Okay? We are talking about material consequences in terms of life, experience, and in terms of access to resources. Okay? Now, epistemic hierarchy, you have Eurocentric knowledge becoming superior over non-European knowledge. You know, like European or Westernized knowledge is superior over the rest. That's what I talked at the beginning. This tradition of thought that is hegemonic, that is epistemically sexist and racist at the same time. Okay, that is the Western male tradition of thought. Okay, that is epistemically racist and sexist, and is pervasive everywhere in Westernized universities. I mentioned before that it is five countries of the world who really brings in what we call social theory. So you cannot have it more provincial than that. And the problem is that it has become so normal to Westernized universities, so normalized this, that if you question this, you risk being accused of a fundamentalist. This guy is weird. He might be an anti-European fundamentalist. That's the reaction I get in many places. Okay. This guy is talking very bad about Europeans. He might be a European fundamentalist, you know? So I become suspicious. But anyway, I'm calling for inter-epistemic dialogues. That means that Europeans could be part of the conversation, but not anymore as at the point zero. Not anymore as the only source of critical knowledge, and we're going to now venerate you and follow you. That's over. Now you come to the conversation one more, and then we could have inter-epistemic dialogues, and then we can learn from each other in horizontal ways. But not the way it's been now, that Eurocentric fundamentalism, which is so ingrained in our common sense, in the press, in the universe, everywhere, that we don't call it fundamentalism. We call it, this is normality, this is social theory, or social science. Well, these are westernized social sciences. Okay? And this is Western social theory, Western male social theory, Western male social science. I would prefer to call it that way. Look just at the departments of philosophy. You go to the Department of Philosophy and you go there and say, you know what, I want to teach a course on Aboriginal philosophy in Australia. That's not philosophy. That's mythology. That's
that's a folklore, or that's religion, or that's, they will come up with all kinds, you know, of labels to that, but that's not philosophy. So what is philosophy? Western male tradition of thought. That's what is philosophy. And what is the background of this? Well, they will say, and we're going to explain that in detail tomorrow, they will claim, because I'm going to discuss tomorrow Descartes, Kant, Hegel, and Marx, okay, for more details. To go each of them, and I'm taking all of them because these are very foundational authors that inform a lot of the social sciences today. And also, I'm going to look at other ways of thinking about universalism. But the way they come up and shut your mouths is by saying, we are universalists. These other people are particularists. We are the only ones that have capacity to produce universal knowledge, and therefore that's why we do philosophy. The other, that's different because they are particularistic. Well, guess what? They are honest. They are saying, I'm thinking from within Buddhism. I'm thinking from within. They situate their knowledge. They tell you from where they're thinking. Nobody's saying, I am thinking from a God eye view. The only tradition of thought that have the audacity and the hypocrisy of talking as if they were thinking from nowhere and talking as if they were producing knowledge from a God eye view is the Western male tradition of thought. So if the philosophy departments in Western universities would call themselves departments of Western male heterosexual philosophy, I will go for it. You know, I will respect it. You know, but that's not the way it comes through. They will say this is philosophy, the rest is not philosophy, and they will establish this racist, sexist, superiority, inferiority. You know, everywhere. You know, and so this is entangled with the whole thing, because part of the colonial project, part of the way the world we live is that we still have this Western male heterosexual tradition of defining for the West. That's what they call universalism. One defining for the West. If you think about it, this is the experience of less than 12% of the population of the world. If you add Italy population, France population, Germany population, UK and US population, is 12% of the population of the world. And if we take women out, okay, from there, we're talking about 5-6% of the population of the world telling us, based on the experience of this, okay, 5% of the population telling us what is universal scientific, social theory, etc. It's really ridiculous when you think about it carefully. And then the rest is invisibilized, is inferiorized, is not part of the conversation, is not part of, you don't find in any bookstore, okay, they're not translated, they're not worth of a translation, okay, so you never know about them. But they exist, and they're there, and they're producing knowledge, okay? The fact that you don't read them, you don't have access, you don't know whatever, it doesn't mean they don't exist. So, part of the logic is then to say, if my knowledge is superior to you, I know what is better for you. So if I need to, I will persuade you. If you are not persuadable, then I will impose it to you by force. And if I have to kill you to save you from your own barbarism, I will kill you. So we went from Christianize or I kill you in the 16th century, to civilize or I kill you in the 19th century, to develop or I kill you in the 20th century, and to democratize or I kill you in the 21st century. And it's always one defining for the rest, saying what is best for you. I know what is best for you. I'm coming with the troops. I put gun in your head, and I know what is best for you. So either you get persuaded, or I will have to kill you to save your soul, okay, or I have to kill you to save yourself for your primitiveness. Well, I kill you because I know what is better for you, because my knowledge is superior to yours. And this is fundamental. This epistemic foundation is fundamental for the whole planet. Okay? Because without that, it's very difficult for colonial imperial projects to produce knowledge accordingly. You see? There will be a contradiction between their knowledge and what they're doing. So part, these structures of knowledge are fundamental and constitutive of the global political economy. Okay? Now, we move into spiritual hierarchies.
So you have Christian and non-Christian as a global hierarchy, Christian, non-Christian. Now, Christian are between Protestant and Catholics. Okay? And you have a global hierarchy that is a spiritual hierarchy where the superior is a Christian-centric world. Okay? Because Christianity is considered a superior type civilized religion over other forms of spirituality. Okay? The other forms are barbaric, you know, they can blow themselves up and kill you, and you know, they have all these stereotypes of being violent, being this, being that, you know, and you know, I mean, we never thought about the violence produced by the system. The others are the violence, you know. So we want to avoid a massacre in a place that might have killed 2,000 people, 3,000 people, and then we go with the troops and kill 1 million. Okay? Because we want to save the life of people. No? Because we know what is better for them. So we go with the troops and we kill 1 million people. And we call it collateral damage when we kill civilians. Right? We call it collateral. That's not state terrorism. The word terrorism is not applied to us. That's the collateral damage. That's the euphemistic term. No? So these are, we never seen the front page of any newspaper Eurocentric fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism have killed 1 million people in Iraq in the last 10 years. We never repeat that. Okay? The fundamentalists are always the others. It's never the West. Okay? The West is humanitarian world. We go, because we're humanitarian. We go there to help people, no? Of course, we never put in the newspaper when they do the contracts with the oil companies and with the gas companies. We never hear what happened after, no? With the resources of the place. Okay? But anyway, this is humanitarian world. So this is all entangled with the question of spirituality and the question of spirituality. Because the moment you take that outlook, okay, where one defines the rest, with no democratic inter-epistemic conversations, okay, then you establish an authoritarian logic in the name of democracy, which is the most contradictory thing. Because it's an authoritarian logic in which I know what is better for you, therefore I don't need to console you. Because I know your knowledge is inferior to me. Okay, I am the civilized, you're barbaric, you're primitive, you're whatever, so I know what is better for you. And then I go and impose a global colonial design in the name of democracy and freedom. So all of this is entangled, okay? This is not separate things. Then, I don't have space here, but we have to continue. So we have pedagogical hierarchies, where we have the Cartesian form of pedagogy being hegemonic, dominant, and superior, and we inferiorize. So you have Western Cartesian over non-Western forms of pedagogies being hegemonic. Okay? In school systems. Other forms of pedagogy, we don't even call them pedagogy. Okay? Aesthetics forms, where you have Western forms of art superior over the non-Western form. And the non-Western form, we call them what? Naive, primitive art. Okay? That's how we call them. Then high art is Picasso, even though Picasso got all his math and all his thing from African artists. But then the African artists, they don't have any name. Have you seen that? Because they think about art in collective ways. They don't think about art in individualistic ways, the same way we think here. So they don't have any name, so they disappear from the map. And then we praise Picasso for being this original thinker, but we don't see where he got this. And who are the artists who produce really these original ways of art forms? But anyway, this is the aesthetics. Then you have linguistic hierarchies, where you have European languages
becoming superior and non-European languages inferiorized. And of course, it doesn't matter if the majority of the world speak non-European language. That doesn't matter. That's irrelevant to this thing. So, for example, United Nations reports, scientific journals are producing three languages: German, English, and French. 90% of scientific journals is produced in three languages. Even though the people who talk those languages are a minority in the world. The language most spoken in the world are not represented in scientific knowledge production, in the scientific journal, completely out of the conversation. Okay? Now, we have age, hierarchies of age. In the West, if you are above 65, you are disposable. Because now you're not anymore a person that, you know, usually what happens in most places in the West, especially metropolitan centers, that you send the elders the family throw them out of the home. They put them in
old people's house.
Yeah, in old people's house.
I don't know how nursing homes.
I'm sorry?
Nursing homes.
So you put them into nursing homes, they become expelled from the family. They're not anymore productive, useful, etc., and the tendency is to put them outside. Okay? No authority, no nothing. In non-Western concepts of age, the elders are people highly respected, are people that have a respect and a dignity in the community. They're not sent to a nursing home, the contrary, they're taken care of, they're respected, they are consulted by people, younger people constantly, you know, they're seen as sources of knowledge, experience, authority, etc. Okay, so that's a very different concept, no? In terms of the age hierarchy. Okay, so you have Western definitions of age vis-a-vis non-Western definitions of age. That's an age hierarchy at work still happening in many places. So you have also ecological hierarchies. Okay, ecological hierarchies, where you have, in the ecological hierarchies, you have certain regions of the world that become the garbage of the world, and other regions of the world that become kind of the ecological safe havens, okay, of the world. And if you watch carefully how is this constructed, you see again the structure of the West and the rest there. Okay? And then you see the concept of nature. Nature, look at that word. That's a very, very Western-centric notion. It doesn't exist elsewhere. Nature is already a concept that is Western-centric. Okay? It doesn't exist elsewhere. Elsewhere, they don't talk about nature. They talk about Pachamama, like the Aymaras in Bolivia. Or they talk about Ahuit in Islam. Or they talk about other, there are other concepts. The best translation is cosmos. This is the best way maybe to translate to a Western language. Cosmos. Which means that we are all in. In the Western notion of nature, nature is something outside the human. We are like exterior to that. We objectify it. Okay? And look at it as something that is not subjective. In Pachamama, the Pachamama is a subject that has a life, that acts, that reacts. When we think about nature, it's inert, it's dead.
It's an object, it's an instrument towards another means. When they think about a Pachamama cosmos, they're thinking about an end in itself, not a means toward another end. Now, the rationality constructed, any technology constructed under the rationality of nature, has the seeds of the destruction of life in its technological performance. Because the moment you take nature as inner object, okay, have no life, no subject, and it's a means towards an end, and the subject is the human that is exterior to it, whatever technology you construct around that rationality is going to destroy life. There's no way out to that. Because you're not thinking about reproducing life in the technological performance, okay, of this technology. You see the point? In the other conception, any technology you produce will have inherently the idea of reproducing life. Because it's not anymore nature, it's cosmos. So we have a lot to learn from that. Okay? We have a lot to learn from that. And that's exactly the debate between the Copenhagen Summit and the Cochabamba Summit last year, no? Where the Copenhagen Summit had nothing to say about how to deal with the ecological disaster of the world, while the Cochabamba Summit came up with a platform of alternatives that are thought from indigenous cosmology, in this case Aymara thought, and Aymara critical thinking. Okay? And they had a concrete proposal. That was the contrast between Copenhagen and Cochabamba last year. That is very interesting to look at. Okay, so you have here an ecological that has embedded a cosmology, a way of thinking, okay, together with structures of power that define certain places as garbage and other places as safe haven for ecological life development. Okay, so you have the ecological structure. So you have also, I'm going to stop it, I can continue. So the question is, look at the, I mentioned these power hierarchies that emerge out of the colonial expansion. This is what I call, this is not colonialism, this is coloniality. Now, why I'm calling this coloniality? Okay? Why use that term colonial here? Well, it's the following. If you look carefully, you have here, each of these hierarchies have ideologies and institutions. You have transnational corporations in the international division of labor. You have international banks and transnational corporations in the international division of labor. Okay? You have states, global interstate system, with the form of so-called nation state as the quintessential form of civilized form of authority. Now, just imagine, nation state, one nation, one state. Whole population with one identity, and the state should have the same identity. Now, think about it. That's, where is that coming from? That's coming from the French Revolution. That's the quintessential example of the nation state. Now, it doesn't work. It didn't work in France. Imagine when you take that scheme and globalize and put it in a colonial way in the middle of Africa, in the middle of the Middle East, in the middle of the Americas. And you pretend that all the people inside that territory, where the boundaries are put in a very arbitrary way by the colonizers, and all the people living there should have one identity and one state. Imagine the disaster you're creating, okay, when you organize the world this way. I mean, all you need is turn on the match and boom, civil war. Because what happened in this structure is always one ethnicity, one group takes over the nation state and start talking in the name of the nation and oppressing the other groups that are not represented in that state. So that structure doesn't work. That's a very Eurocentric understanding of political authority. And it's not working. But that's the main institution of the world system today, the idea of the nation state. It doesn't work in Europe, today, you could see the prices of that all over Europe today, and much less it works elsewhere. In places like Africa, we have 20 ethnic groups inside a territory. Okay? And you pretend that one ethnic group will become the leaders of that nation state and pretend that everybody will have the same identity inside that state. That doesn't work. That's a failure. That's why indigenous people in America today, in Ecuador and Bolivia, are calling for plurinational societies and are changing the constitution of their countries and talking about a plurinational state instead of a nation state. Okay? And this has a lot of implications because it's a completely different form of thinking about political authority that we can discuss in more detail as we figure out in the discussion. But anyway, so you have the state and you have as ideology militarism as the way to solve social problems is militarism. Okay? Nation state as the quintessential form of political authority, okay, as an institution, and the ideology is militarism and developmentalism. These are the two main ideologies. Then you have Judeo-Christian patriarchy with sexism and heterosexism, and the institution is the Judeo-Christian family, that you have it globalized, okay, around the world, the Judeo-Christian family. You have epistemic hierarchy, you have Eurocentrism as an ideology, and the global westernized university system. If you go to a westernized university in Berlin, in Paris, in New York, in San Francisco, in New Delhi, in Beijing, in Dakar, in Buenos Aires, in Rio de Janeiro, in anywhere around the world, it's the same. You read the same guys. It's the same guys that you're reading. It's not transformable anywhere because it's a model, the Western universities that have become globalized as an imperial colonial design, and that's what you get everywhere. Okay? It's a colonial global institution that is part of the colonizing process to produce the westernized elites in the third world that will work for the West. Okay? That's what that structure is doing. And epistemically, it's Eurocentric or Western centric, okay? For the reason we already discussed. Spiritual hierarchy, you have institutions, the church, Christian or Protestant, being globalized everywhere. You have Christian centrism as the ideology. Pedagogical hierarchy, you have the school system. Public school, elementary school, based on the Western Cartesian notion of pedagogy. Okay? And then inferiorize, destroy other forms of pedagogy, other forms of thinking about school in many parts of the world. You have the aesthetic hierarchy, okay, where you have a Western superiority in art, that is a Eurocentric way of thinking about art. And then you have the museums, and you have the art galleries and the art markets that becomes the institutional framework of this global structure. Then you have the linguistic hierarchy where European language are privileged over non-European language, and then you have the many places you have the language academies. Language academies that will define what is correct English, what is correct Spanish, what is correct Portuguese, what is correct French, and things like this. Okay? So you have institutions enforcing a particular way of speaking. Then you have the age structure that you see this in the family, because it's also entangled with the Judeo-Christian patriarchy. Then you have the ecological structure, and you see this also entangled in institutions that institutional spaces around the world. Okay, where you have certain places that become the garbage of the world. Okay. So when you look carefully, I mentioned how you have ideologies and institutions in each of these hierarchies, but when you examine carefully, the global racial ethnic hierarchy has an ideology which is racism, but you cannot point at any particular institution.
I cannot say the institution of the law of racism or the law of racial hierarchy is this one. I cannot point at anyone in particular. You see the point? The question is why? And this is where I answer the question about why coloniality, why the word colonial there? Because this is the organizing principle of all the others. If you examine carefully how we have been thinking about all this global hierarchy, it's always the West and the rest. As being the configuration. And the West and the rest is configured this way because the racism and the idea of race become the organizing principle of all the other hierarchies.
Okay.
For example, if you look at the International Division of Labor, if you look who is doing the peripheral work and who is getting the privilege of metropolitan, who is in the zone of being, who is in the zone of not being, is organized along the lines of racial hierarchy. If you look at the question about Judeo-Christian patriarchy, and you look at the way the questions of sexuality and gender are configured, and you think about these hierarchies in terms of how they are organized, you see how there is cut across by questions of racism. Zone of being, zone of not being. Not the same thing to be a woman oppressed in the zone of being than to be a woman oppressed in the zone of not being. These are two different experiences, very different from each other. Okay. So, just to give you an example. Epistemic hierarchies, look. Western and Western knowledges. Okay. So you have, again, racial hierarchy, racism, or an organizing principle, which knowledges are privileged and which knowledges are inferiorized. The same thing with spirituality. Which religion is being privileged, which religions are inferiorized. And so on. And we go over all the hierarchies and you see that racism is an organizing principle, okay, of all the other hierarchies. Okay. Now, how to think about this system? There are two discussions I want to have. One is, the moment you look at the system this way, now look what I'm going to do, please. This is what I'm doing now. Because I don't want you to understand the system as columns like this. Because then you become a Weberian. You become Max Weber. That is, you start looking at the world as in a fragmented way, as if one thing has nothing to do with the other, as autonomous spheres. Okay? And that's not the way it works, as I'm trying to explain. It works in entanglement. Therefore, the image I'm giving here for communicative reasons, you know, doesn't work. Because I don't want you to ontologize this as if they were spheres of the real, you see, that are separate one from the other. I don't want you to look at the world this way. I'm avoiding the question, and we discussed that yesterday, of the last instance. I don't want superstructure infrastructure, because that's reductionism. And you could see a reductionism over the economics in Marxism, and you could see a reductionism over the culture in many social theory, but especially among the post-colonial, many post-colonial, not all, but many of them. So, I try to think in terms of intersectionality, heterarchies, multiple hierarchies entangled to each other in complex ways, heterogeneous historical structures, using a different metatheoretical framework that has been produced from thinkers of the South, that allows to think about these things in complex ways because they cannot afford the luxury of dividing the world like that, okay, or reducing everything to one thing. That's a luxury they cannot afford, the critical thinkers of the South. They are always forced to look at the connections of things and to look at the entanglement of power relations. Okay, so that's why I crossed the whole thing, because I don't want you, I prefer if you get an image of this, something like this, an entanglement. that needs to be historicized. Because the way the entanglement occurs in one region of the world is not going to be the same as other regions of the world. It's going to be a diverse experience according to different local colonial histories and different histories of empires, etc. So you need to account for this history to understand how this package of multiple power relations gets entangled in complex ways in different regions of the world, including within the West. How this is entangled in different ways within what we call the West, no? Not just what we call the periphery, no? So the other question is how to name this. I refuse to keep talking about capitalist world system or global capitalism. I refuse to use those terms. Because the moment I come and tell you capitalist world system, oh, this guy is talking about the economics. The economy. What I'm talking about? Is this economy? Is this anthropology? Is this political science? Is this sociology? What the hell is this guy talking about? Well, I'm not bounded by discipline. I prefer to think transdisciplinary. And that's the way many critical thinkers of the South conceive their work. Because we're not thinking about the problems of the discipline. We're thinking about the problems of the world. We're trying to think about the problems of humanity, that humanity is facing today. If we get caught in the problem of the discipline, then we become what Afro-Caribbean philosophers call disciplinary decadence. Which is, we produce knowledge to be read by ourselves in academic environments that are irrelevant to the rest of the world, that do not address the problems that we face in the rest of the world. So I prefer to avoid disciplinary decadence and not be married with any discipline and think in a transdisciplinary way, which means now that I refuse to use the term global capitalism. Now how I call this? I prefer to use a phrase that at the risk of sounding ridiculous, okay, it's a long phrase, okay, and might be very ridiculous when I say it, but I prefer to use that in order not to invisibilize what is at stake, okay, than keep using global capitalism. That doesn't, it just invisibilizes everything that is at stake. It leads you to think that the problem is an economic problem, and that's what happened with 20th century socialism. 20th century socialism was, again, a global imperial colonial design of what the critical thinkers of the zone of being that produced a so-called scientific ideology, from where they pretended to find the solutions for the rest of the world, and became another imperial global design, as is the Europeans who are here, what it meant, okay, to be dominated by the Soviets, or as Germans who were on the other side of the border, okay, what it meant. So this was a global imperial colonial design from the left, because they fall again into the same entanglement of having one defining for the rest, but not from the left. Okay? And I know what is better for you. And because I know what is better for you, I try to persuade you. But if you're not persuadable, then I send the troops. No? Or I send the KGB. No? Well, this is the other side of the coin. The left and the right, in terms of what we're discussing here, of the decolonial project, is it doesn't work. Because left and right is still caught within the same framework of what I'm calling here the coloniality of power. And again, the problem is that 20th century socialism thought that if you solve class, you solve the rest. That's why I refuse to call this system global capitalism, because I would be misleading you. We're talking about something else. This is a civilization. This is not an economic system. This is a civilization. Okay? And I prefer to call it the following way. I would call it modern colonial, because there's no modernity without coloniality, as I explained yesterday, capitalist patriarchal, Western-centric, Christian-centric world system. That's the way I prefer to call the growth, the world society in which we all live. Okay? We live in a world society, and the world society in which we live is a civilization. And I call it a civilization because it has ways of behaving and thinking about how human beings relate to each other. It has ways of thinking about who is human, who is not human. It has ways of thinking about how to relate with the cosmos. It has a cosmology. It has epistemology. It has ways of forms of domination, forms of exploitation, forms of sexuality, forms of gender relations, etc., very particular to the system we live. And therefore, I prefer to call this we live a civilization. A civilization that indigenous people in the South and Aboriginal people call a project of death. And they call it a project of death not only because this system has killed more human beings in world history, okay, but also because it's destroying life. Life understood in a non-anthropocentric way. That's why they call it a project of death. So this civilization is a project of death. Is leading humanity and is leading non-human life into death. And so the problem we're facing is that in order to destroy this system, you cannot rely on only one hierarchy. And that's what happened. You need to organize in whatever hierarchy of power you're embedded in intersectional ways. What happened with 20th century socialism? The proletarians were fighting the capitalists, but when they organized in sexist ways, in heterosexist ways, in racist ways, in Eurocentric ways, in Christianocentric ways. And then it got corrupted. Because if you organize in racist ways to fight capitalists, if you organize in sexist ways to fight capitalists, if you organize in heterosexist ways to fight capitalists, if you organize in Eurocentric ways to fight capitalism, then you bring in all the civilizational power relations into the picture, and it will corrupt whatever you do. It will end up corrupted. And that's what happened with 20th century socialism. It became a corrupted project that ended up, and this is a debate, I prefer to call it state capitalist. Okay? Because it was a kind of state capitalist system, okay, run by some bureaucrats that became the capitalist in terms of the production process, in terms of many things. But they were racist, they were sexist, they were heterosexist, they were Eurocentric, they were everything else. And so the whole thing got corrupted. The same, I will give you another example. I live in San Francisco. I don't know how many of you know Castro Street, or know what I'm talking about if I say Castro Street. Castro Street is a famous gay community in San Francisco. Okay? Back in the 70s, there was a huge struggle by gay people in San Francisco for the conquering of this space. It got to moments where there was armed struggle. Okay? They were shooting each other at the police. Okay? It got to violent moments. Now, what happened with Castro Street? This struggle is very interesting to analyze because it's a metaphor also what I'm trying to say. They were all fighting together, all gays, of all colors or all Western, no Western, whatever, to conquer the space. But then they organized in sexist ways, in Eurocentric ways, in racist ways, the whole thing got corrupted. And now Castro Street is a space where only white, capitalist, misogynist, gay males are the ones who control the space. And now discriminating against non-Western gays in the same space. And now a non-Western gay have no access to the place, it's too expensive. Or if they want to go to a club, they look suspicious and not allowed to enter. Or things like this. So the whole thing got corrupted the moment they did not organize in entangled ways, in intersectional ways. Just to give you an example of a struggle that is more micro, of the community in a... So the point I'm saying is, if we think about this as a civilization rather than as an economic system, it has political consequences about how to go about fighting the system of power structures. It has political consequences. Okay? Because if you think about it as a civilization, as a capitalist, patriarchal, Western-centric, Christiano-centric, modern colonial world system, then you understand that there are many things at stake, and you have a more awareness of that there's more at stake than just an economic system. With that, I don't want to underestimate the economic problems that this creates. I just want to say that then, after saying everything I said, you cannot think about the economy anymore the way political economic paradigms used to think. Because now you take all these other logics as constitutive of capitalist accumulation at a world scale. Now sexism, racism, all these things are not anymore superstructural or epiphenomenal. Now they are organizing principles of the way political economy operates. And now we cannot think the way, the traditional way Marxist political economists used to think about political economy. Because now we need to understand that the political economy is already constituted from within by all these civilizational power hierarchies. It's organized from within by all these other logics. It's not anymore that these logics are derivative or epiphenomenon of capital accumulation. It's the other way around. It's that capital accumulation is organized from within by these other logics. And we cannot think anymore about the economy. That framing is already doing a violence to what is really happening, because what is really happening is more entangled. And in a sense, the global division of labor or core periphery is not just an economic hierarchy, it's also a racial ethnic hierarchy at the same time. For example, because whoever is located in the privilege of the poor, or whoever is located in the disadvantage of the periphery, it does inform by where you located in the racial ethnic hierarchy. If you are in the zone of being or the zone of non-being. I'll stop here.